Hello and welcome to the Music Retailers Podcast. I'm your host, Donovan Bankhead, and together you and I are going to listen to and learn from some of my favorite instrumental music retailers, manufacturers, well, anyone else that I think would be interesting. My goal is to provide a podcast where you can learn something new in every episode.
At Springfield Music, we started using Merchant Cost Consulting earlier this year. These guys are former banking and credit card reps who go and negotiate your processing rates on your behalf. Now, like most of you, we're pretty aggressive about shopping our processing rate around, so I wasn't sure they'd be able to save us much money. But boy, was I wrong. On average, they're saving us about $600 a month. The deal is we split it 50-50 with them for so many months, and after that, all the savings are ours to keep. Plus, they keep an eye on your fees during this time to make sure those freaking credit card processors don't find a way to jack up your rate again. They're good folks, and they do what they say they do. Actually, in our case, they underpromised and over-delivered. They estimated about $500 a month in savings, and it's been closer to $600. When you contact Patrick at Merchant Cost Consulting, tell him that Donovan Bankhead sent you. This does two things. One, they will pay me a slight referral commission. But more importantly, two, you'll get 10% off of your first month's bill if you choose to go with them after their free analysis. Listen, I wouldn't recommend it to you if it wasn't worth it. It'll only take a few minutes of your time. They handle the rest. Contact Patrick McClellan. His email is patrick@merchantcostconsulting.com. P-A-T-R-I-C-K at merchantcostconsulting.com. I'll even give you a cell phone number, 508-733-7622. And remember, tell them that Donovan sent you.
Well, I'm really excited for today's episode. I have wanted to have this conversation, I think, from the moment I heard of Cosmo Music. And so today, Mark Hebert, from the president of Cosmo Music, is joining me on the Music Retail Podcast. So Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Really glad to have you here. Glad that we're able to get this to connect and get us together today. So my first exposure to Cosmo Music, I bet, is similar to probably most of my listeners, which was at a NAMM Top 100, probably the first one that you all were nominated for, I would imagine, store design. You've been nominated for a bunch of these things. And just amazed by your store, it almost looks like someone put a musical instrument shopping mall inside of an office building. It's just mind-blowing. The first time I saw it, just thinking like, what in the world is this 54,000 square foot music store doing in Canada of all places? Like, blew my mind. And so I've been very just interested in it. And I would love to hear the story. I did a little bit of research, and people can go to your website, see pictures and stuff like that, which is really interesting. But your dad started it, right?
Like, yeah, way back dad started in
68 as like importing guitars from Italy and Japan. And then started thinking like maybe this could turn into a store. So tell me that story of how he began and how it actually went from sort of the importing side into retail.
Sure. So we're in a suburb that's just north of Toronto, but basically what we call the Greater Toronto Area, which is one kind of amalgamated geographical space. So we're next to a huge population of people. But my father started, it's actually a great story. He started importing guitars and thought he could make a go of it selling to dealers. At that time, instruments from Italy and Japan weren't recognized as the highest quality, similar to what we went through with Chinese manufactured instruments. Now everything's made there, but that was similar back in the day with Japanese and some of the European countries' instruments. But he started importing them, found he wasn't as successful as he could be with that endeavor, but the facility happened to be located on a major road. And so he opened the doors and started to sell them to customers off the street, and found he was selling more that way than he was distributing to other dealers. Now, my father, he's an Air Force, Canadian Air Force background. He was a mechanic in the Air Force. And so this was his passion. He actually worked for a small store before he opened up his distribution in Richmond Hill, which is the town we're located in. And as the story goes, he worked for this man. It was called Mundinger Music for, I don't remember how long, but he worked for free. He just wanted to learn the industry. He is extremely intrigued. It was his passion. He had a band in the Air Force. which I still have pictures of. You just really wanted to get into it. Similar to how I think most of us get into this, into the business. It's a passionate industry. So years after he started his distribution business and started selling retail off the street, the man, the Mundinger, decided he wanted to retire. So he phoned my father and said, listen, I really cherish the time we spent together, and I couldn't believe that you worked for free, and that stuck with me, and I want to sell you my business. And that's basically how the retail store got started.
And it started, I mean, pretty humble beginnings even back then. I mean, you've on the website again, you've got your story, and it has pictures of these original stores, and they're just sort of like your normal mom and pop music stores. So you kind of moved locations a bit, and then it seems like in 85, there was sort of a big jump up that you guys kind of, you know, made a bigger investment in real estate and move forward. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, I don't remember the dates offhand. I'd have to read the website like you're doing, but yeah, there was...
I'm cheating.
As we grew from that original location, which was in the downtown core of Richmond Hill, which is where we still currently reside, not in that facility, but in the town, we just started to branch out. So we outgrew that location. We needed more space. My father opened up other locations. Some of the primary location was divided into multiple different spaces as we grew. So there was an offsite repair shop. At one point, there was an offsite band and orchestra division, which housed all of our rentals and some of our brass and woodwind repair facilities and our office space and warehousing. So it went through many forms. There were multiple locations at one point, at different points in time as we grew. And when I came on board, we kind of assessed the situation. And the big store that I think you're talking about, or the biggest of the group on the land that you're referring to, that land was prime for development. So it's right on Yonge Street. If anybody knows Toronto, it's the major corridor. I believe Yonge Street still is the longest street in the world. But it was a prime retail corridor, and it was ready for development. So we had an opportunity to sell the land and actually get quite a bit of money for it and kind of build our dream building, which my father had been dreaming about for years and years and years. So what happened is we kind of made a plan, and we started folding all of the locations into each other. So amalgamating all the best salespeople, the best managers, until we were down to the one building. And in the meantime, we were planning purchasing the land and planning the building, which was going to be built on Leslie Street, which is two streets over from Yonge Street. And we opened those doors in 2008. So it was a good 8-year process, folding all of those locations into the one.
And so at one point you had how many locations?
I think at one point it was up to 5 different locations. Now, some of them weren't retail. Some of them were on-site repair facilities or warehousing facilities. But yeah, it was quite a process.
And then what was the distance between like the furthest of the locations? Were they're kind of all in the same neighborhood roughly, or same part area roughly?
They're all in the greater Toronto area. So the furthest one would have been in Scarborough, which is probably a half an hour drive from our primary location, but in a different part of Toronto. Toronto's very spread out. It's similar to London, England. Any major city. And as time went on, they kind of engulfed more and more city areas into the primary GTA. So it's a huge city. And I believe the stat is like in the southern part of Ontario and Quebec, in that corridor, you know, starting where the Great Lakes are and all along that kind of southern strip of Ontario and Quebec, including Montreal and Quebec City, is somewhere in the neighborhood of like 46% of the population of the entire country. So we have access to a huge amount of population.
Right. And so spread about 30, you know, multiple locations spread up to 30 minutes apart and then consolidated into one
big
superstore. Yeah, 54,000 square foot store. Your claim is it's the largest music store in North America. I don't know. Is that still true?
At the time, it was what we referred to as the largest interactive music store in the world. So it had the biggest showroom of things that you could touch and feel and play. Now, since then, I think in Europe, there's been several large music stores built, like interactive music stores. And even in the US, there's been duplication of that large music store format as well. So whether we're still the largest, I'm not sure. But at the time it was built, it was by far the largest interactive music store on the planet.
Interesting. So, and at 54,000 square feet now, do you happen to recall how much square feet you had occupied when you had the five separate locations total? It's okay if you don't. I was just curious.
Probably in the 15,000 to 20,000 square foot area. And I should know that because I did the analysis of how many square feet for each department we would require in the new facility based on the total square footage we had in each department in the multiple locations before. But that was 15 years ago, 20 years ago. So I don't remember offhand. But yeah, it was somewhere between 12 and...
So five locations, the total amassed square footage was around 15,000 square feet?
Yeah. Well, yeah,
those were very small locations. Some of them would have been,
a
1,000, 2,000 square feet. Others would be larger.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So then from 15,000 to 20,000 square feet to 54,000 square feet is a huge difference.
I think it's actually 56,000. I only know that because we just did we're in the process of two major construction projects within the building itself, increasing it to over 60,000. So the square footage of the building is now over 62,000 or something square feet within the building.
So what was it that you were anticipating changing in the business to need double, nearly triple the square footage you were currently occupying? To go from 15 to 20 to, between 50 and 60 is a huge increase. What was it that you were anticipating changing that you need now?
It was kind of one of those build it and they will come moments. And at the time, given the circumstances that the former property was going through, it was a question of, do we build on this property, which wasn't big enough? And going through the exercise of saying, well, this is what we want, but this is what we can have given the constraints of the size of the property, the old property, or do we really go for what we really want? And at the time, we knew it had to be part of the goals where it had to be a destination location. That was number one. So people had to travel. It had to be big enough and good enough for people to travel far distances to get to. And number two, it had to become a brand authority exercise because our next concept after we had built the store was to start really developing our e-commerce and digital strategies. So it had to be a brand authority for that purpose alone. So people looking at the website and understanding that we're a legitimate music store, one of the biggest, something that can be said and people feel comfort. There's a certain level of comfort that comes with that from a customer's perspective.
How much of the store then is dedicated towards retail and how much of it is dedicated toward either e-commerce or office or whatever? So basically like what's the square footage of the showroom?
It's definitely more than half is showroom space. It's somewhere between 30 and 40,000 is showroom space. Keep in mind, we have 39 lesson studios. So that takes up a large chunk of space. We have a performance theater in the store that seats 250 people. And in between the lesson department and the performance space is a large waiting room. There's obviously the office space, which you mentioned. We have a 12,000 square foot warehouse, which we recently built on. So it's about 15 to 17,000 square feet now. But the rest of it is all retail space. If you include the atrium, and then there's a repair shop. That's about 3 to 4,000 square feet. So the atrium is kind of a central hub, which also has our Starbucks in it, which is currently closed down due to COVID. But we have a Starbucks retail franchise, which we own in the atrium space as well.
What was the process of getting a Starbucks into your store?
That's a unique story. We have a yearly festival called Cosmo Fest. We've been doing it for many years. It's a large consumer trade show. So we build a huge tent outdoors with fully carpeted floor. And then we have trade show booths for suppliers to come in and present their products to customers. We have a kids area in this festival. We have a food truck alley. I think the last time we held it, it was 25 food trucks or something. And then we have a huge outdoor concert venue with a huge beer tent. with big name artists that come in and play. And it's a 1 day festival. So typically we have a lot of sponsors that come in, and one of the sponsors that the year that we were, one of the years, many years ago, was Starbucks. So we either have usually Tim Hortons, which is a big, mm-hmm. franchise up here. But for whatever reason, Starbucks came in and they wanted to sponsor it. And sponsoring it with coffee means they pull up a truck and they serve free coffee all morning, right? They're really, it's just an advertising exercise. And while they were there, one of the managers that happened to be there was involved in their franchising group. And franchising isn't a big thing for Starbucks up here. There's not many at all. But as soon as he saw the people, so we get upwards of 15,000 people come through on that day, and he saw the foot traffic. He's like, we need to have a store here. So he was kind of the one who started that, the ball rolling. We had a cafe there before. And coincidentally, when I went to approach him to say, ooh, we bought a Starbucks franchise, we need you to move, he said, well, actually, I opened up another location down the street and I want to move too. And so it worked out perfectly.
Nice.
The timing couldn't have been better.
Is there enough location or enough traffic in your store on a normal, on a Tuesday to support a Starbucks?
So pre-COVID?
Yeah.
Very, very much so. So lessons, we get over 2,000, or at pre-COVID, again, numbers, we had a peak about 2,000 lesson customers coming through per week. Which means parents and people waiting in the waiting room. We had 265 staff members, all who drink coffee and need lunches and snacks throughout the day. And then we have events all the time. So we need catering to those events. In our theater, we host corporate events. We have management meeting events. We do concerts, clinics, master classes, private teacher recitals, and many of those things require catering. And then, of course, just the general foot traffic of both customers coming through. And we're located in a commercial area, so we have multiple towers around us. There's a government building across the street, a federal government building, and with 600 employees who all need coffee. And then we have other buildings down the street. So there's a lot of foot traffic to support, in normal circumstances, support the Starbucks. Right now, right. None of those things are existing. So there's very little lessons. There's all of the buildings around us. There's no one working there. And there's limitations on the people we can have within the store. So the foot traffic is simply not there to have the Starbucks open.
Right, right. Unfortunate, but that'll be hopefully over soon. And
we have our fingers crossed, yeah.
You had mentioned earlier when we were just getting set up, Toronto is roughly 90% vaccinated, which I'm super envious being here in Missouri, which is, I don't know our latest numbers, but the last I heard it, we were still below 50%. So hearing that you had being over 90%, is, I'm very, very envious of it for sure.
Canadians, for the most part, are pretty compliant.
Well, yeah, I wish I could say the same thing about Americans, and that's certainly not the case. So,
yeah.
All right. So one of the first things that just sort of took me away from the first time I saw pictures of your store, and again, if people aren't familiar with it, please, I'll include links to images of your store in the show notes, but just blown away by that view from the atrium of sort of seeing all these little stores within a store. And like I said, it's almost like an outdoor indoor mall for musical instruments. It's the craziest thing with the style and stuff. Tell me how that design came about.
So that again was part of that 8 to 10 year process. We visited hundreds of stores across the globe, you know, from Asia to Europe, many stores in the US. We had much of our senior leadership team taking notes on some of the best aspects of those parts of the store. And then we had the vision of my father. So he needs to have credit for the original vision, which was basically exactly how you just described it, kind of a shopping mall for musical instruments. That concept flowing with the designer's ideas, and actually our designer came from an automotive dealership background, and a lot of them at the time were putting in cafes, and they had these kind of grand atrium ideas. So applying those into my father's vision made sense. And then the concept behind it is being big enough that we can have a store that when people walk in, they kind of understand that it's, there's value. So families can feel comfortable, similar to when you walk into a Target or a Home Depot. Mm-hmm. You feel that you're going to get value. You don't question the prices. You don't question the value and the expertise of the people in that store. Yet also be able to offer artists and musicians, once they enter into those smaller boutique areas, a feeling of being immersed with the things that they love in particular, and not clouded or smoked out by other things. So if you're a guitar player, you want to be immersed in guitars and know you're speaking with a guitar expert who only works in the guitar department. And by separating off all of these departments, we kind of achieved that. And we even subdivided some departments even further. So our guitar department is subdivided into kind of the high-end room. So once you get in there, you're not just submersed in only guitars. You're immersed in high-end instruments, high-end electric instruments, high-end acoustic instruments. And some of them are in the current version of the store are by brand. So there's branded store within a store. So we have a huge Taylor guitar room. We are the first on the globe to have that. It was kind of like a beta test with Taylor guitars. And when they liked what they saw, they rolled out that program with rooms and walls around the globe. Mm-hmm. I think there's well over 200 stores that have that same concept. We have a Martin room, so similar kind of idea. We have a Fender concept store, again, one of the first in the globe. And there's more coming as well. So we've currently built out a big mezzanine, like a second floor in a guitar shop. And there's two more, a specialty store within a store concepts arriving soon, hoping to have the grand opening of that in the new year.
Well, obviously that store within a store concept is one that's paying off. You feel like it's effective, it's worth growing for. When you do something like that, do you partner with the vendor? And what does that partnership look like?
Yeah, we typically partner with a vendor. Well, we always partner with a vendor. There's larger inventory requirements, purchasing requirements. We like to add a digital component. So although we've gone through a couple transitions with our website, when we originally installed the Taylor room, we also created a similar styled area online for people to shop. We just relaunched our website. So that's disappeared for now, but we'll be returning shortly. But yeah, there's a huge commitment on our hand with the vendor, and it's showing a commitment to the brand as well, because that we're not going to be changing up store within a store concepts every year. Right. There are things that are going to remain for many, many years to come. So the brand knows there's a commitment on their part, and so the commitment has to be returned likewise. But every store within a store concept we put in has had a drastic, and I mean drastic, effect on sales.
In general, and you can be as vague or as specific as you like, what kind of partnership, what kind of support are you looking at from the vendor when you do one of these?
It's a mixed bag. It really kind of depends on how much the store within the store concept is going to cost the vendor. And that's kind of taken into account. So if the fixtures are going to be extremely expensive, that's taken into account. If they're not, then there might be a dollar value affixed to the retail space. There's no rule. It's kind of a creative and liquid kind of arrangement that's made.
Gotcha.
So there is no answer to that question.
Right. It kind of case by case, but there is some kind of commitment and investment from the vendor side of it to participate in that as well. And it's looking for sort of a win-win outcome for both of you.
That is really the only goal. So whatever is a win-win, and we're both willing to invest, whether that's money, inventory, commitments, year commitments. So it's not just about money. It's about all the other aspects as well.
Yeah. So I think anyone that has been through the top 100s and seen your slides and presentations roll across the screen, and who would listen to the things you're describing of doing these big 15,000 person events and Starbucks in the store and everything else, would be really amazed, and rightfully so. But our company is large enough to understand that you can't do all this stuff without a pretty impressive team of people to do it. No one person, and maybe unless we're Elon Musk or something like that, but no one person has the genius and the intellect and the ability to pull this off together. And tell me about your team, and specifically at what point you started really building out this leadership team that went from, I'm sure in the early days, it's like your dad, and then just kind of whoever's sort of around helping out. And then it starts, you start to add a few people here and there. But to get to one of the largest music stores in the world and in North America and everything else, it requires a really thorough leadership team. Tell me how that process really came to be where it is today.
Yeah, so it's not about me. I surround myself with people who are smarter than me in their particular fields, each and every one of them. I might be good at dreaming up crazy ideas, and that's my role. They're the ones who implement those ideas and or come up with the ideas themselves based on the knowledge and experience that they have in their particular field. So I'm fortunate enough to have what I would describe as the best people in the industry on the planet. That's what I believe. And they've allowed us as an organization to really grow quickly. Now, it's always a risk. You know, when you add a new person to a senior leadership team, whether that's HR, marketing, or all sorts of people, it's a risk. You're taking a risk because you're hoping that the addition of that person will pay off. It's never not paid off in the past, and it's always proven itself successful in terms of numbers. But we as an organization tend to kind of stretch the limit of what is possible. So we're always kind of on the bleeding edge of technology, the bleeding edge of logistics when it comes to warehousing, the bleeding edge of HR. And we really try to stretch those limits both from an ideas and vision perspective and from a financial perspective as well. So we're always putting our money where our mouth is and trying to improve ultimately what ends up being the customer experience in the store. But yeah, it's the people that matter. So, and it's not just the leadership team, it's all the people in the entire organization that matter. Each one has a voice.
Sure. And each one's important. I mean, you certainly can't do it without them. I mean, that's without a doubt. I mean, if there was a position in our company that we didn't need to have, we wouldn't have it, you know?
And that's right.
They're all super, super important. I think one of the things within our company that I like about how we view things is we view all of us as employees. And I think because I was an employee for so long before I became an owner, I even today still view myself, I'm an employee. Like, I'm an employee of this company, and I have a role and responsibility to fulfill. And my role is really no more important than anyone else's. So I think that a viewpoint is certainly a very healthy viewpoint. And I think it's a viewpoint that's helped us to be able to still attract and recruit and retain great talent, even during a time when there's a shortage of people in a very, very tight labor market. I feel like we could still do much better for employees that we do. If I'm being truthful, like, employee appreciation and stuff isn't something that comes natural for me, but it's something I work at. And I hope my people see that and I hope they appreciate it more, knowing that it's not something that comes naturally to me, but I work hard at it to try to show my appreciation for it. And certainly grateful for the team that we have and for the people that we're able to bring on as well. And I'm not surprised at all that in an organization your size that you feel the same way. The last podcast that I did with Crystal Morris, which was a really great conversation, she's alluded to something similar to what you just said about how sometimes making those key hires, those investments in those new positions can be somewhat daunting at the time, but generally most often prove to be the right decision when you're at that point that it's necessary. I think you could probably do it too soon. And I'm thinking specifically in our case, we hired 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, we hired someone to be our vice president of finance. And up until that point, that was really a role that I had played. But gosh, we'd have been so much more financially successful since bringing her on. But I don't know that we would have been able to afford or we would have benefited, but affording it may have been hard to justify back when we were doing, you know, a quarter of the revenues that we were doing, we brought her. So there's sort of a time and a place to do it. But at the time, even it seemed like an expensive investment that we hoped to pay off, which it certainly did. And Crystal had kind of shared that same story. And she also shared something that was also very enlightening. Sometimes you have this need for a position, or you feel this need for a position, you hire someone. Sometimes you hire the wrong person. And that doesn't mean that the idea for the position's wrong. It's just that person may not have been the right fit, which I thought was really insightful on on her part, and probably voiced from experience, as I know that I've certainly had that experience.
Your story about hiring a VP of finance and Crystal having the same story, I have exactly the same story. And I was highly embedded in the finance aspect. And that hire for me personally was a huge weight off my back. So very important for me to free up my time to start doing additional visioning for the future and strategic planning. So that was a huge hire. Also, strategically planning how you want to increase what we call our senior leadership team, because we have a couple layers. We have our senior leadership team, and then we have our leadership team, which are all of the managers across the entire organization. But what typically happens is you hit a plateau, and that plateau can typically be seen where you're not achieving the kind of revenue increases you're looking to achieve. And those are the times you need to break through that brick wall and figure out how you're going to make the next leap. So figure out what your BHAG, your big, hairy, audacious goal is, your next step, how am I going to get there? And typically what that encompasses is hiring an additional person for your senior leadership team who can bring the experience from outside of the industry to implement on in your organization, who's going to help you get to that next level. And that's typically what happens. So every step of the way, whenever we've hired a new senior leader, it's to break through that next level or to achieve a goal that you'd set yourself as part of your strategic vision, but are unable to accomplish, but you know is necessary to move forward. So I want a couple of our most recent senior leadership team additions are, we have a VP of sales and customer experience. And that's a recent new role that we have. And so he's looking after all forms of customer interaction and revenue. More importantly, the customer interaction, because ultimately that hits your sales. And we kind of also morphed the manager of our buying group into a VP of procurement. So he's responsible for procuring anything, whether it's an asset or a license or inventory for the store. And whether that's for our own retail purposes or our sister company, we also own a distribution division as well. So we distribute to other dealers across Canada. So it's acquisitions for inventory acquisitions for that as well, as he's ultimately responsible for.
The VP of sales and customer experience. Let's dive into that a little deeper and tell me more about exactly what that position is and what it's responsible for.
So that's going to morph into all sorts of different things, but ultimately it is changing the way we work internally to help increase sales numbers. But those tasks are specifically oriented to how we can better serve the customer and have better customer experiences, whether it's online, in store, whether through our educational channel, meaning our servicing our music teachers in our public school systems and our other boards of education, going through each of those customer experiences and seeing how we can improve those and or stretch them even further to serve even more customers. His first task is he's going through many of the current offerings that we have and making sure those customer experiences are seamless and integrated. So someone who is shopping in the retail store has a similar experience than when they shop online or experience a lesson from either our in-house or online lesson platform. One of the first challenges is he's trying to take the customer's viewpoint of what Cosmo Music is, which whenever they interact with us, they see us as one holistic store.
Mm-hmm.
But that may not be the way we function internally. We're siloed into different departments, right? And so it's kind of taking what the customer is seeing from us and making that a reality within the store as well. So everyone under the understanding that a customer could go from buying a guitar, take the discount upstairs to sign up for lessons. And all those experiences have to be similar in nature and seamlessly transition from one to another, which is something as you grow, you have to formalize those processes. Let's look back in the days of when my father started the store. My dad would sell a customer a guitar, and it was my dad. He'd ask them, hey, do you want to take lessons? Here's the teacher. Let's go log you in to take lessons. When you come back, here's my business card in case you need some adjustments made on your guitar. So that customer experience was holistic, where the customer understood everything, right? But as you grow, it's kind of got get divided up. And so it's bringing it back to the roots. And how do we make this one cohesive experience in the customer's eyes?
That sounds like a very challenging rule.
It's very challenging, but there's a lot of opportunities there. We've just gone full circle. That's the reason we introduced that role, because the opportunities we saw there far outweigh the expense of adding that additional role at the organization. There's so many places where we can improve and customers can be served much better.
I think it was Herb Kelleher, who's a founder of Southwest Airlines, said that if you want to get big, act small. And if you want to get small, act big. And so what you're describing is, it's so funny thinking about, like, all right, we're trying to get our huge modern music store company to sort of act like the way it did in the 70s when my dad was the only player, you know, like who on the just running around doing everything. And you're right. Like, you customers want that experience, that very personalized experience, regardless of the size of the business.
That's right.
And they want it to feel like if they're taking lessons, if they're in the repair shop, if they're renting an instrument, if they're purchasing a guitar, they want it to feel like if they're doing business with the same entity, it shouldn't have a different feel all throughout it. And I can imagine how that could be very difficult with over 200 people and everything else. So let's shift gears a little bit. I always like to get people's opinions on our industry. And since you've got such a unique viewpoint of a long family history in it, plus also being involved in the wholesale and retail side of it, I'd love to know, tell me what you think is right with our industry, some of your favorite points of our industry.
So I think, as we all are aware, things that are right with our industry is, I don't think we'd have any argument that we are extremely fortunate to work in this industry. It's a passion industry. We get to come into work and see kids learning instruments in our lesson departments, picking up a guitar for the first time, and the joy in their face and in their eyes, the happiness of your team members when they get to pick up that new piece of gear for the first time when it's just launched and get an employee discount and begin teaching themselves. There's very few instances in which there's not happiness in the store, whether it's online, customer support, in store, in our theater with live performances, which generates the kind of good-natured spirit and culture that we all get to experience every day. And we're lucky. And I think we take that for granted. And I will say oftentimes when something's not going quite right with my leadership team or my senior leadership team, I'll say, hey, we could, no offense to like the hat industry or the sock industry or the cardboard, the corrugated box industry, but imagine we did that. And every day you came to work and you were making black socks. It's not the same thing. And that typically picks up their spirit a little bit, because we're very lucky to be in this industry. And I think we do that right. And I think our trade organization too, NAM, is an incredible asset to us, which we should all take advantage of. And that same spirit and passion is in everyone who works at NAM as well. And I think that's another thing I think we take for granted, is that we have such an incredible trade organization, and some of us don't know how good they actually are.
Yeah, I totally agree. I feel like there's more appreciation for it now than there has been in the past, possibly. But I remember, you know, 10 years ago, seven to 10 years ago, often hearing, especially independent retailers, complain about NAM and that they don't do enough. And I just look and think, what more could you possibly ask for them to do? Like, they do so much already. Like, it's such, they provide such tremendous value, and with educational clinics and a great convention and all the attention that it gets and the people that come in, like, I don't know what more you could ask for them.
Yeah. And they lobby the government. I mean, I've been on Washington, D.C. lobbying, even though I'm not an American citizen, so I wouldn't benefit from that. But just to experience it and see how that works and see any takeaways for our own country. But it's incredible the efforts that our trade organization go through to lobby the government and to create more music makers and get dollars in the hands of music teachers. It's quite a feat.
Yeah, it really is. What are some of the things you think that could be better about our industry?
I think, given the long history of our industry, there's a lot of antiquated processes and ideas when it comes to retail in general. Although we can learn from other retail sectors, we typically tend to bury our heads in the sand and say, well, this is the way it's always been done. It has to be done this way. And I think really to advance as an industry, we need to start looking outside of the box. Because I think as things rapidly get digitized and rapidly escalate, there's going to be a drastic amount of change that we're going to see in the next few decades. And all of us need to work together to think outside of the box and change our habits and change our mentalities. So as a group of independent retailers, we can be successful.
Any specific examples stick out in your mind of things that are antiquated that we are holding on to?
There's lots of examples, but for instance, there's a lot of retailers in both of our countries who either refuse or think it's too daunting to create a website, list products on a marketplace like Reverb, engage people in a digital way. I think that's something that people are going to have to do. They're going to have to get over it. They're going to have to figure out how to do that because that's the way customers are going to want to engage in the future.
Sure.
And so I really hope that all independents can learn, can find their path in how they can engage people in a digital way so all of them can be successful.
In their defense, I totally agree with you, but in their defense, in our industry specifically, it's a huge lift to do any of those things. It's a bigger lift in our industry than it is in others. If you're in the furniture industry, if you're in the pet industry, if you're in any, probably nearly any other consumer-facing industry, the process of getting your products from your store to online and third-party representation is a minor task compared to what it takes for us. And I'm always boggled at how difficult it is just to get photography and descriptions and get products listed. I can't believe it. The process is really no different today than it would have been in the 90s and early 2000s for the music industry. Whereas my friends that have pet stores, they're like, oh, you don't have this wholesaler that you use? And like, bam, just all these products are now on your night. No, we don't have that. You know?
You're pointing to exactly what I was referring to. Our industry can be antiquated. I'm not suggesting it's the dealer's fault. I'm saying there aren't systems and processes in place to make it easy for us, whether that's NAM involvement, whether that's dealer groups, whether that's suppliers, distributors, and brands getting together to make it easier for us to do these things. You're talking to the right person when it comes to discussing the difficult challenges there are for listing products and on their own website and on multiple marketplaces. We actively list a 250,000 SKUs. That's actively curating 250,000 SKUs on multiple marketplaces. And in our background, we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 400,000 to 800,000 SKUs that we're constantly putting in and out. It is a monumental task, and there's little to no help from others. It's all done by ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we still face these challenges, like what you described, even though we're a big online player. Those challenges still exist. And I think there's a way that we can share together things that will make that a lot easier for people to jump on board as well.
What needs to happen in order to make this process so much better, more efficient, and more automated?
I don't know what the answer to that is. I know NAM has some efforts that they're involved in clean up data and making some of those processes a little bit more seamless. But, you know, I'm not sure what the answer to that is.
So we've heaped a ton of praise and well-deserved praise on our friends at NAM. So this is the one thing that we will admonish them to get after is this, because I agree with you that this process is so critical for independent music stores to be able to survive and to make it. I've got people that I was in a sharing group in that they have a chain of pet stores, smaller pet stores. They're relatively smart people. They're good operators, but they're no more smarter or knowledgeable than many, many, many people that I know in our industry. And they have technology provided from their industry that makes the ability to compete against some of the companies like Chewy's and whatever easier for them. They have a website with their products. They have a system set up to be able to do auto fulfillment for dog food shipments and so on and so forth. This wasn't something they had to build out of the box. It was something that their industry was able to provide them. And certainly I'd love to see NAMM take an even stronger role. Tell me what you think the future looks like for Cosmo Music over the next 3 to 5 years.
I think it's mostly a digital play. So I know we're adding fuel to the fire to increase our revenue through our digital platforms. And I see us scaling in the next 2, 5, 10 years through both digital outreach, new revenue streams that are formed in a digital manner, whether that's schools or lessons, events. But to put it in a nutshell, it's all digital is where we're moving.
Interesting. Is that because just the ability to grow that you can have large exponential growth in that without necessarily requiring square footage and everything else necessarily?
It's the lowest hanging fruit. And when you've saturated your own local geographic market, it's really the only place to go.
Gotcha. What do you think Cosmo Music looks like in the next 10 to 20 years?
I'd answer the question in almost identically. I think now we're stretching into a time where a lot of the younger people who have become accustomed to shopping from home are now they're the future parents and the future customers and the amateur musicians, and it's just going to grow that digital market. So hence why I would encourage dealers to try to figure out a way in which they can satisfy customer requirements in that way, because I think it's the future, and to ignore it, I think it would be a mistake.
We've talked so much about like the size of Cosmo and like all the things that you all are involved with. If you had to revert back down to a normal sized big music store, a 10,000 square foot music store, what would be the products or services that you would make sure you retain?
I would focus primarily on services. I think that's where the bread and butter is. I think product sales, it's a difficult thing, but mm-hmm. the complementary services involved in those products, if you don't have an online presence, is really what's necessary. So investing in your lesson department. Lessons is a difficult one because a lot of them I think are going online, but investing in your repair shop. If you have a small pro services division, investing in that, because that's not going to go away. We do something called Gearheads, which is similar to Geek Squad at Best Buy. Investing in a program like that to find repeat sales in your local market. So I think services is the answer to that question, because doing a really good job of those services and providing a customer experience that's unmatched in the industry in order to compete will ultimately bring product sales as well.
It's interesting you say that. I feel like over the years, our business has changed that we sell products in order to be able to offer the services that we offer, because we make more money offering the services, but it would be harder to offer those services without the retail part of it being there.
It all goes hand in hand. And right. For us, the development of customers and brand recognition starts in the hands of our musical instrument rentals, in the hands of school children.
Yeah. So
all those trumpets and trombones and clarinets, and they remember our name from when they rented it in grade school and high school.
Yeah.
And so it all starts there.
Yeah. It's a great answer to that question, I think. So tell me about a negative situation you've experienced in your business career that ultimately ended up having a positive outcome, but you don't want to repeat it.
So back in the days, we've had since before I was involved, and then when I was involved, the worst experiences were dealing with financial institutions. So like everyone, we have a bank, we borrow money to grow whenever we have our next crazy idea, and convincing banks to back you and support you was always a very difficult process. And especially in our industry, the inherent misunderstanding, now every industry was going to say this, but I think ours in particular has a valid excuse, is the inherent misunderstanding of the value of our inventory, in particular our band rentals, and how those appreciate is a difficult thing for financial institutions to understand. the difficult thing for financials to understand our long tail inventory and why our turns are so low in certain product categories. So convincing banks and dealing with financial institutions is something that was some of the worst experiences, plural, that I ever had in my career. And I'm fortunate enough that we now have a CFO and he deals with that. And it's not even changed. So it's the size doesn't change all of those issues. They just become more complex and bigger.
Right.
I hope to personally not have to deal with that ever again, nor would I ever wish that upon my CFO either. So I'm hoping we're at the size that isn't a factor anymore.
New officers in that bank have the new vision or new ideals or goals, and all of a sudden their opinion of you and your business can change drastically.
That's the problem. You're the golden goose until the account rep changes or they move on somewhere, they're promoted within, and then you've got to explain your business all over again. You go from golden goose to in the doghouse overnight. And that's a reoccurring story that happened to us. And I'm sure it's a reoccurring story that could be happening to other dealers as well.
And then finally, if you could send a message to the younger you, what would you say?
Oh, I would say it's all about the people. So that's a perfect full circle we just took there. It's all about the team you have. It's not about you and your ideas. It's about the team you have underneath of you. Never pretend like you're the smartest person in the room, because you're not. Rely on the visions of your people as well, because they're the ones who are going to make you successful. So surround yourself with smart people.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's certainly been the key to the success I've had in our industry. I've been very, very fortunate to have just some fantastic people around me along the way. And it's those people that I enjoy working with. And early on, when we were testing the recording and stuff, you'd mentioned you've been working at home quite a bit. And I just told you how much I'd miss it if I wasn't able to go in and see my people. I do like working from home, you know, from time to time. I think today I'll probably spend a fair amount of time working from home. There's a certain peace that happens to it. And right now, as I look across my house, it's just me and a cat and two dogs. So it's quiet and peaceful. And I know like I can get quite a bit done, but I miss getting to see the faces and talk to the people that I work with every day, even if that does mean a bunch of interruptions. But
they're your family, right? Like
they are. They are.
Our people, I mean, our senior leadership team, the average tenure is well over 30 years. So they're the people I've grown up with over my entire life. Is your family outside of your nuclear family?
Yeah.
In fact, I spend more time with them than I do with my own family. They're important. They're your family, and make sure to treat them well.
Yeah. Well, Mark, this was a great conversation. I think there's lots of great comments for people to sort of chew and stew on and think about. And it's been really, really interesting to learn more about your business. Like I said, I've been kind of a fan from the first moment I saw those pictures flow across the screen at an AM Top 100 and think of like, who is this store that I've never heard of? This thing is mind-boggling to comprehend.
And I think for many years we flew under the radar, so we didn't really participate in those things, and then we kind of decided, well, we're going to out ourselves, and when we started participating in the NAMM Top 100, like we really participated, and we started participating in more trade organizations and all sorts of things, and I think we realized that we could not only learn from everybody else, but we could also participate and help others as well, and we've taken that active direction ever since then.
It's such a great position to be in. It's something that I love. I am so grateful for all the people who've shared their knowledge with me and their experience with me. It's been the key to growing Springfield Music over the 20 years that I've been there. Wouldn't be able to do it without these mentorships and friendships, people willing to share. And then in turn, it's just so wonderful to get to be able to turn around and help other people as well. And it's something I truly enjoy. And I noticed that people on my team feel the same way. I've got Misty Kristek, who's our VP of operations and lessons. And when she gets to work with other music stores and help them with questions they have, whether it's about the lessons, especially, which is kind of her passion, like she just kind of comes alive getting to, you know, help someone else solve a problem that we have solved or brainstorm some solutions. And that's really exciting to get to see her do that. And our repair technicians, when they go to NatBERT conventions and get to learn from other people and share some of the things they've learned with each other, like they just, he gets so animated and excited. And I just love those things and glad that we can provide those opportunities.
Well, that's a wrap for this episode. If you'd like help with your business, check out musicretailconsulting.com for articles, resources, and coaching and consulting services. Also, you can subscribe to this podcast so you're aware of future updates and rate and review while you're at it. Thanks for listening.